Hey guys, thanks so much for watching or listening to this message. We're excited about what God's doing across Village Church, across all of our sites, around the world, all the stuff we're involved in. If you want to help resource it, this is villagechurch.com/give. Would be awesome for you to labor with us as we try to serve people, serve you, serve Jesus in the mission that he's given to us at such a time as this. This is villagechurch.com/groups is the way that you can get involved in community groups. We do them online so you can join anywhere in the world. We gather people from all different places to go through sermon material, talk about life, pray for each other, walk through things, celebrate. And then even if you have a group of people who are in a particular city or town, we can get you guys all hanging out together. So it's pretty cool the amount of people leaning in and becoming part of these groups. So hopefully you enjoy the sermon and hopefully you guys are having a great week, and we will see you next week. Hey guys, Pastor Mark here. So glad you are joining us online or at any of our physical sites. Man, we are super pumped that we are going back to in-person gatherings at our Surrey location, our only location right now that isn't gathering in person, on September 26th. So if you're someone who lives in Surrey, maybe you've never even been to an in-person gathering and you've joined us online since COVID, get pumped, get super excited, get there. If you're someone who attends that site, awesome. September 26th, write it in your calendar. We're super jacked. The other thing is this though. We need, at all of our sites, people actually serving in ministry, especially when it comes to kids ministry. Here's the domino effect that we are finding. People are obviously slow to sign up, and I get it, we're in summer, but now, starting now, summer's over, which is kind of sad, and we're back to school, we're back into routine, so that means we need you to get back in routine, because there are literally kids and families wanting to come to church, show up to church, and they can't. They literally set their alarms. I was talking to one family, and they get up and they get online to sign their family in, and all the spots are already taken. Now, the reason that happens isn't because of COVID. It's because we can only let a certain amount of kids and families into church because there's a certain amount of people serving, and that is limited. And so we can't let kids in the room. So we need a lot of people signing up to serve at all the sites, all the cinema sites, Langley South, Surrey, all the sites need people saying, okay, I'll step up, I'll serve in kids ministry, even give us 2 months of your time, whatever it is, I'll actually lean in, I'll be an usher, I'll do whatever it is that you can do or have done in the past. We need you now that the fall is here, summer's over, to actually step up, because we're seeing, and here's what happens to the human heart and rhythms in our life. Very natural, but we need to fight it a little bit. Our rhythm is, we've kind of served you, it's called the gravedigger effect, sociologists call it. We've served you as best we can. Like, we use technology, we sat in these rooms, we did all this stuff to make sure that during COVID, you could actually be discipled and grow closer to Jesus. But now here's what's happened. You've got in the pajama rhythm, all right? You're sitting in your PJs, drinking your coffee. You don't have to shower. You don't go and get in your car and serve. You don't, like, so all of that has become now your rhythm. And now you're like, oh, maybe this isn't something I need to do. Maybe I don't need to serve. Maybe I don't need to be present. We actually need you to fight that a little bit, because we actually need people serving. So we've served you well. We've loved you well. Don't make us turn this off, all right? Because we actually need people to serve in our physical location so that other people can actually be reached for Jesus. Families, kids, people of all ages and stages in life. And we're literally having to limit them showing up to church because we don't have enough people serving. So make sure you follow the links if you're watching this online. Make sure you're looking at the newsletters. We will give you links in order to serve. We need you to do that. That's the heart and spirit of Jesus. I mean, we're studying a book right now, the Gospel of John. If you got your Bibles, open it to John chapter 7. We're going to jump into the verses after what Chris finished last week. But we're moving toward a time in chapter 13 where Jesus is the one who literally shows leadership and mission by getting down and actually washing his disciples' feet. That has always been the heart of Village Church. We want to love and serve our city, love and serve one another by actually serving. Washing feet, not literally, but showing a posture of, we want to actually reach people by serving, not having people just serve us. Okay, Jesus, you serve me and we're good to go. It's like, no, be the Jesus in that story and actually love and serve other people sacrificially. That's the big heart of Village. So we need you to do that starting now. And so we're looking forward to seeing you do that so actually we can continue to grow and reach people. Okay. Oh, John chapter 7, verse 14 is where we're going to start. Chris ended off at 12 and 13 last week. And so here's what it says. Yet for the fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly about him. This is going to be interesting. No one, meaning the crowds and the disciples, as they head to Jerusalem, no one is going to speak about Jesus. I'm going to talk about that in a second. Verse 14, about the middle of the feast that he's talking about is, and this has been, there's a bunch of feasts that are talked about in the Gospel of John. The feast that we're talking about is the what's called the Feast of Booths. All right, so there was three pilgrimages a year where Jews went to Jerusalem and they celebrated. This was one of them, the Feast of Booths. And what it represented was this idea. It was called Sukkot, and it was the Jewish holiday that celebrated the years, the 40 years that Jews spent in the wilderness trying to get to the promised land, and God kind of helped them build these makeshift tabernacles so that they could exist for 40 years in the wilderness. And after they came out of Egypt, and it took them 40 years to get there. And so this was the celebration that they did every year where they came together and actually celebrated those 40 years. So this is what we're talking about. They're in the temple. Now the temple represented both God's presence and the forgiveness of sins. That's the place where both those things happen. And here's Jesus going there to upstage both of those things, which is beautiful because we as Christians understand that in Jesus Christ, that's where we get the presence of God. And in Jesus Christ, that's where we get the forgiveness of sins. So he does this. He's always kind of hovering around the temple in John to make these huge theological statements to change the theological vision of Israel and the world about what access to God and what forgiveness of sins actually looks like. It's beautiful because they live in a super symbolic culture, even more symbolic than the one we live in. And so sometimes it's hard to understand. Like I was watching a documentary on 9/11. Of course, we're in the 20-year anniversary of 9/11 as we sit here. And the reality is like, why did these people from the Middle East take out the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, supposedly one maybe going toward the White House? What are those moves? Those are symbolic moves. The two towers are the symbolism of world trade and economy and Western civilization and all of that. And then the Pentagon is this defense and the war and the army. These aren't just like, okay, what's the most populated places and let's go hit those so we can do the most amount of damage and kill the most amount of people. They were symbols. And so the Middle Eastern culture is super symbolic. Everything they do has symbols. We miss that in the Western world. So when Jesus is hovering around these places, he's doing it intentionally. He's trying to make a theological point. So here they are celebrating the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, it's also been called. They're all hanging out. It's like New Year's Eve in New York City, Times Square. It's jacked up. It's like people are wearing t-shirts and bands are playing. I mean, it's like a Christian conference. I don't know if you've ever been to a Christian like musical conference or a huge like a celebration. Everyone's walking around. I went to one a few years ago. And it was like people were wearing like Guns and Moses t-shirts, you know, this kind of stuff, right? It's like you got a lot of like the fish on the back of the cars, like in the parking lot, and everyone's kind of talking about Petra or whatever. I don't even know what that is. But it's like everyone's jacked up. Everyone's talking about this kind of stuff. It was a festival where Christians were gathered, and there's this rumor afoot that like they're trading out their Bibleopoly pieces and waiting to, and there's a rumor afoot. Literally someone found out I was a Christian when I first got married and their wedding gift to me was Bibleopoly. So you're literally buying up spaces. Like they got it at one of these conferences for sure. And it's like Boardwalk was Jerusalem. All right. Like this is what we're talking about. So, cause they thought that's what I would play. It's like, I'll trade you Corinth for, you know, it's like, no, this is not a thing in my life. So anyway, so that's what they're all there for. And there's this rumor, there's this whispering that there's a guy claiming to be the Messiah and he's doing miracles. So of course he's gonna show up here. He's gonna announce his run for president in Jerusalem. And yet, here's the crazy thing. He goes into no one speaking openly of him up into the temple and he began teaching. He begins teaching, but he begins doing so super subtly. And then there's this piece of it that's actually like, It's secret. So if you read chapter 7 in verse 4, it says this, "For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." That's the disciples' play. No one wants to reveal themselves. Like, if you want to really make impact, you got to be public about it. That's their argument. His pushback to them, verse 10, but after his brothers had gone up to the feast, because he says, I'm not even going, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. Here's the crazy thing. Jesus upends all of our expectations. Jesus does the opposite to what we expect him to do in this moment. And he does it in our life every day. We think that, man, here's the way to make me grow as a Christian. God, you want me growing closer with you? You want me walking with you? You want me being sanctified? Here's what I want you to do. Bless me, give me health, give me wealth, make things go well for me. And I'm gonna step back and go, man, God is so good, right? That's the agenda that we set out. And of course, he doesn't do it that way so often. There's pain in our life. There's suffering in our life. I was talking to a guy the other day, and it was almost this approach that all of us have to figure out. It's like, when those times come in our life, are we recognizing it as this is what God's doing in my life, or are we recognizing as I don't want to believe in God anymore? I was talking to a guy with pancreatic problems the other day, young guy, dealt with it. His wife was dealing with health issues, and he looked at me and he said, I know this sounds really bizarre, but the intimacy I have with Christ now, I wouldn't want to have that taken out of my life for anything. And I'm like, what are you, like, if, like, this is kind of what the Bible does. It's like this interesting world where if you're going to a church and people believe that suffering is always, it's never the plan of God in your life, run. Because there's people who really think that. They go, oh, you can't even say disease out loud because that means you're gonna invite the disease in your life. Listen, that's like witchcraft. That's not Bible, all right? You look to anybody in the Bible who's the center of the story, there's pain, there's suffering. Go to Job, go to Joseph, go to Jesus, go to Paul, go to Peter, go to the early church. Suffering, 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 in order to create in them, Paul argues in Romans 5, a kind of perseverance, a kind of character in their life. So here's Jesus doing things in ways that we wouldn't necessarily do them, but this is what he does. He upends all of our expectations. This is what theologians call the upside down kingdom. Jesus does things in an upside down way to such a point where all the people that, and this is what Jesus' ministry does, all the people that you thought were in are out. And all the people you thought were out were in. This is why everyone's confused about Jesus. This is what I love. He's like the liberals didn't like him because they were like, you take the Bible literally. You teach that there was a literal Adam and Eve, a literal marriage, literal male and female, literal resurrection, literal marriage, literal miracles. We don't believe in any. Get out of here, Jesus. You're too literal for us. You're too conservative for us. And then the conservatives didn't like Jesus because he's partied too much and they called him a drunkard and he hangs out and he's having too much fun and he loves the poor too much. Don't you know if the poor just work a little harder, their situation will get figured out? He's a socialist, he's a communist. And everyone hated Jesus because of all this. They're freaking out. And here's the best part about, I love this, this is great for us today. When he has an opportunity to do all this, he shows up in private and he doesn't correct the misinformation for a minute. When he has an opportunity to correct and clarify and make clear what he thinks about everything, he doesn't. And it blows our mind because we realize that it wasn't necessarily his calling to change every social structure, to make everything clear for everybody all the time about what. Now, of course, there's implications, but half the stuff we're talking about today, Jesus isn't super clear about, which is a beautiful image because, man, I try my hard in this cultural moment right now to do my best to be like Jesus in this way, because people direct message me every day. Mark, you need to lead, you need to be a voice in this. Why aren't you speaking about this and that and sermons and blogs and videos against these people or those people? And I'm struggling in a sense because I do have an opinion about everything that's going on right now, but my main task for you right now in this moment is to actually try to reach people on both sides of all of these issues with the gospel of Jesus. That's my main calling as a pastor, as a preacher and a teacher. Because if I was to just choose a side every single time and clarify what I think about every single issue, then I just become a political pundit and I lose the other side. And my main goal is to reach people with the gospel of Jesus so they go to heaven when they die and not hell, and they have a life where they're given eternal life and joy and peace in the present, not that they believe with my political views on some temporal issues that in time will pass, will evolve. Of course, Jesus, the teachings of the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus, my own understanding of reading out of all this stuff for the last 20 years, it's like, I got ideas about how all this should go down. I have opinions. But what is my job right now? To not clarify on every single issue that comes across my plate. That's the idea. And here's the complicated nature of Christianity, guys. And this is something that hit me this week. And I think it's something we all got to really think about. Sometimes we as Christians are supposed to do this and not that. And sometimes we're supposed to do that and not this. And here's the other complicated reality that's going to blow our mind. You ready for this? Because this is not sitting comfortably. This will not sit comfortably with most of us. Sometimes some of us are supposed to do this, and some of us are supposed to do that, and that's okay. Now, before you're like, what do you mean? My black and white boxes are getting all screwed up here. Listen, you go back through church history and you understand over 2,000 years, there are different streams, and Christians believe different things about different realities. And so when we say Christians are supposed to do X, what do we mean by that? Lutherans or Catholics? What do you mean? Anabaptists or Pentecostals? Baptists themselves, Protestants? Which Christians are you talking about? And so I was reading this week in John Stackhouse's book, Making the Best of It, which is a great book right now, which strikes up this tension that we all feel in this moment, where how Christianity and culture connect to one another. And he says this, my main point is that in some cases, no single stance says and does all that must be said and done. And therefore, more than one posture might be necessary to cumulatively bear witness to the broad scope of God's word and will in a complex matter. Put a little more strongly, I think it makes sense of a fundamental historical reality. Christians of obvious good sense and good faith have disagreed about lots of things, and it's not clear to me, at least, that one side or another was always just wrong. Think about how humbling that is. Can we live in the nuance that there's not always one monolithic response of Christians to whatever issue is on the table? There's a variety of nuances and ideas in particular moments and particular times. And in order for the world to see a fully rounded church witness, there's not maybe just one political party or one political view that's the way. And if you doubt that, go and talk to Christians of different ages, different stages, different races, different social standings, and ask them what they think about the issues that we get so clamored about, and we have kind of this one view on everything, and then you start to open your dinner table up a bit. And you start to realize different races and social classes and the poor, they deal with all of these things differently. And sort of come in at it as if there's, like my brother-in-law, Indian background, Hindu background, became a follower of Jesus. My brother's wife, my sister-in-law, she's Chinese. So when we sit around, there's all these kids. It looks like the UN, bro. I mean, it's just like, what is our view on X? And it's like, well, what do you mean? I'm coming from a Chinese perspective on this. I'm coming from an Indian Hindu past background on this. Now I'm coming from a Christian view on this. And everyone's coming together. So what's the view? There's nuance here. And there's a kind of humility where Jesus goes privately. You got to underline, circle, double click that reality. Jesus does stuff backwards and upside down and counterintuitive to what we think is going to work. And there's a freedom in it. And so verse 15 then, it says, he's up in the he's doing some teaching in the temple. We're not told what he's teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he's never studied? Now, of course, it doesn't mean that he'd never read the Bible or never like picked up a theology book. What they mean, because every Jew growing up had memorized large swaths of the Old Testament and knew theology, whatever, far more than we tend to do. What they mean is he hasn't studied, like he didn't go to seminary and become a priest or a rabbi or a scholar. He's a regular Joe. The rest of the Gospels, if you take them collectively, they tell us that he followed in his father's footsteps, shows his footsteps, and was a carpenter. So here's Jesus, he's a carpenter. Why is he so smart about theology? Why is he always telling us what God really thinks about salvation, whatever? And this is what we've got to understand. Dallas Willard talks about the idea that Jesus was the smartest man in the world. And you got to realize that what this smartest man, it's easy to say that, of course, if you're a Muslim and you're watching this right now, if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Sikh, if you're an atheist, an agnostic, a Jew, and you're watching this right now, a Jehovah's Witness, a Mormon, you might say Jesus Christ was a smart guy. You might kind of agree with what the, man, this guy's ever studied. He's got some brilliant ideas. But here's the understanding that if you don't understand that Jesus Christ is actually claiming to be God's son, and you don't buy into that, which of course for some of you, if you're watching this, is a heresy. The idea that Jesus would claim to be God's son is literally a heresy. The fact that he claims to be divine, the fact that he was claimed to be born of a virgin, all of this stuff is heresy in a lot of religious constructs. You have to understand that just saying he's a good teacher, as Lewis said, when you actually start to dig into his teachings, if you don't accept that he's God, then he's not actually a good teacher. That's the irony of all this. He's actually a terrible teacher. And Lewis said, he's like a crazy person who thinks they're a fried egg. It's that level, unless you buy into the fact that he actually is God's son and he's perfect and he's divine. He came to die for the sin of the world. You buy into all that, then he's a good teacher. Outside that, his teachings are actually terrible because he manipulated people and he lied. And so at the end of the day, all of us have to kind of ask that question. Do we think Jesus is just this good teacher, or was he actually the son of God? And that, of course, becomes divisive. And so we as a culture move away from it, and we don't like the exclusive nature of Christianity, where it says Jesus is the only way, that he's God come down the mountain. And so we say, well, all views and all religions are fine. We all like Jesus. He's a good guy. So we move on with our life. But the problem with that is that's not what any actual other religion thinks, right? Tim Keller talks about this in his book, The Reason for God, doing a church in New York City. He says, I was once invited to be the Christian representative in a panel discussion at a local college along with a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim imam. The panelists were asked to discuss the differences among religions. The conversation was courteous, intelligent, and respectful in tone. Each speaker affirmed that there were significant, irreconcilable differences between the major faiths. A case in point was the person of Jesus. We all agreed on the statement, if Christians are right about Jesus being God, then Muslims and Jews fail in a serious way to love God as God really is. But if Muslims and Jews are right that Jesus is not God, but rather a teacher or prophet, then Christians fail in a serious way to love God as God really is. The bottom line was we couldn't all be equally right about the nature of God. Several of the students were quite disturbed by this. One student insisted that what mattered was to believe in God and to be a loving person yourself. To insist that one faith has a better grasp of the truth than others was intolerant. Another student looked at us clerics and said in his frustration, "We will never come to know peace on earth if religious leaders keep on making such exclusive claims." That's the scandal, is that Jesus is actually making exclusive claims. And the question is not just whether he's a good teacher, but have you looked into what he taught? And do you accept that? Because if you don't accept that, then he actually isn't a good teacher. And so you look at this guy's never studied, and he's so learned. All right, but if what he's saying isn't actually true, then he should be forgotten about. He should be rebelled against. But if it is true, then we need to accept him as more than a teacher. That's the tension. And the beautiful thing here is they push back. He's never studied. I think we tend to picture Jesus, like when he was living on earth, that he walked around and like was just like maybe a foot off the ground, kind of floating, and he had like this aura around him, and like in a sea of like people who looked all the same, you know, he stood out. You know, maybe everyone's got brown or black eyes in that culture, but he's got blue, you know, and he's like, bzz, you know, he's just like, and he's all jacked. He's like, and his clothes are never dirty. And it'd be like, just looking, going, oh, there's Jesus in a crowd of 5,000. We totally can tell. And we kind of been fed those images. And of course, if he was like that, then no one would question him. They wouldn't go, I don't think he's actually right. In fact, later, it's that he's leading Israel astray, right? You know that. Like when he gets tried at his trial, one of the things against him is he's leading Israel astray. That's how he's viewed. He's a false prophet, according to Deuteronomy 18. And a false prophet wasn't just told to take down his blog. A false prophet was killed. And so they're pushing back against him. They're pushing back against his ideas. They don't accept him. And here's the great thing for our life. Man, Jesus' life was constantly slogging it uphill. It was never easy. And that's the beautiful part where Jesus exemplifies for us discipleship. He always had resistance. And you and I got to understand, life sucks, right? Life pushes back. Since Genesis 3, when we fell and God cursed the earth and said, you're not going to be able, it's going to be thorns and thistles, man. Work is going to push back against you. Your boss is going to push back against you. Your marriage is going to push back against you. Your health is going to push back against you. Everything in life just seems to be, it just gets twisted and messed up, and nothing can be perfect. Nothing can be set. Money, making more money, being successful, friendship, it's just always pushing and grinding. And here's the question. You either take it like Jesus and go, this is what God is doing in my life to form me into who I need to be. I follow a one who ends up at the very center of the will of God being crucified. Or I give up and I go, I can't handle the pressure. I can't handle the pushback. I can't handle the resistance. I can't handle the difficulty in my life. And I'm going to shut down and give up. It's what one writer, Jay Neal, calls the help of opposition. He says this, a certain amount of opposition, writing about manhood in his book years ago, is a great help to a man. Kites rise against and not with the wind. Even a headwind is better than none. No man ever worked his passage anywhere in a dead calm in a boat. Let no man wax pale, therefore, because of opposition. It is what he wants and must have to be good for anything. Hardship is the native soil of manhood and self-reliance. He that cannot abide the storm without flinching or quitting strips himself in the sunshine and lies down by the wayside to be overlooked and forgotten and falls asleep in the stillness that follows. Guys, it's what Gladwell calls the advantage of disadvantage. It's the difficulty that grinds us into the person that God is making us into. And I know almost every person watching this right now, there's some aspect of your life, statistically speaking, that is difficult, that just feels like it's pushing back. It feels like there's opposition. It feels like there's people, who is this guy? Why should we follow him? He's not even learning. People don't understand you. Circumstances don't understand you. Whatever it is. Man, can I tell you one of the hardest parts of my job is this. Preaching. I know some of you just think I'm making this up as I sit up here, but it's actually the most difficult part of my job. It's the bane of my existence. As much as I love it, it crushes me almost every week. The study, the mindset, the commentaries, but then there's the every, you know, Friday writing it out, and every Saturday getting into my office at 5 p.m. every single Saturday for 11 years. and having I'm a social person. I got my friends texting me, we're at a party and they're taking pictures of themselves. But I gotta grind out and memorize this sermon and think of an illustration for the people that are gonna watch. And I look in, it's kind of like those Home Alone, you know. I like look and I see my kids in the windows and they're building memories and it's all muted, you know, to me because I'm just looking in the window from afar, going, I just want to snuggle my, and they're all laughing and I'm sitting outside memorizing sermons for you. And it's a grind and it's the hard, but then it's the place where I love the scriptures and meet with God every week in a special way and laugh and cry and try to figure out how to do this. And if the sermons help you at all in your life, it's like who God's making me to be on purpose through the difficulty, through the heaviness. It's the hardest, heaviest. I talk to any preacher. The hardest, heaviest spiritual day, emotional day of their week is Sunday, because you get up and you feel like you're walking through molasses. There's a spiritual, emotional, mental dynamic here. But then you see the fruit of what you do for yourself and others, and you realize it is in that grind. It is in that opposition that you're being made into the person God makes you to be, for the world, for yourself, for your family, whatever. It's through. And so Jesus exemplifies this in such a beautiful way. And so take encouragement from it. He constantly faced resistance. And then it says, so Jesus answered them, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. I love this because Jesus, they're going, where did he get all this information? He says, verse 17, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. So this idea that, look, I didn't just come up with this on my own. They're asking, which rabbi is he getting this from? And he's going, I'm not getting this from another rabbi. I'm getting this from God himself, which is why the people always throughout the Gospels go, I can't believe he's teaching as one with authority. It's like he's getting his message from somewhere. And this is what Jesus claims. I'm not getting this from rabbi this and rabbi that. I'm getting it from the Father. The Father has actually told me, it's the one who sent me. He gave me this. This is why if you're new to our church and you wonder why we go through the scriptures every week and then bring it into our life, it's because these are the words of God for the world. This is the Father downloading his will, his ideas, his theology to you. And so as Augustine said, the Bible is the face of God for us now. It's the sure thing now. And that's why as a church, when we come together, we just sit on this and go through it text by text by text, because we want to understand what God thinks, not what we all think, not what I think. We've all had preachers and teachers and leaders fail us. And that's the point. Jesus is going, I'm getting this from God. So I want you to actually test everything I'm saying against the scriptures, not just ideas that I happen to have because I had some bad pizza last night. That's why we build our whole life on the text. And week in and week out, you ever wonder why when I come to Village Church, is it like singing? And then a guy gets up and he just verse by verse through the Bible. It's because I want you to think based on this thing, not based on me. And this is why what we're doing, the best of my ability. And this is what Jesus is saying. There's authority. I'm not just working from my brain here. The Father is giving me this. And I love it because so often we're about Jesus as a church, but then you look at the teachings of Jesus and he's about the Father. And let's understand to bring in our Trinitarian theology, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, fully God, eternally one, eternally distinct. Sometimes the Father doesn't get the attention he deserves in our life. It's like worship, prayer, a relationship with the Father. This is constantly what Jesus is on about. I'm just teaching you stuff the Father told me and gave me. It's like my daughter Hayden showing up at youth group or something and saying, hey, you know, my father thinks that the postmodern milieu is based on a post-Foucault, post-Freudian, post-Darwinian, you know, Stanley Fish epistemological understanding that he feels misses the, and everybody like, what? What are you talking about, Hayden? You'd be like, I don't know. I'm just telling you what my father told me. It's what Jesus is doing. He's saying, I'm not just riffing here. God told me this stuff. And so do you worship the one who sent me? Do you worship the Father? Do you pray to the Father? Do you walk with the Father? Do you love the Father? Do you understand the Father's calling in your life? Again, here's what Jesus does. Now, listen to this. This is a crazy verse that's going to mess with us again, but I love it. So look at what he says. He says in verse in verse 17, if anyone's, look at this, this is crazy. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God. Okay, guys, here's what I love about this. It's totally the opposite to most things I preach every week. All right, and here's what I mean by it. This is why I love it. What we tend to say is if someone is going to do the will of God, right, in their life, if they're gonna, you know, live a Christian life, then the first thing upstream that they need to do is know God. They need to like think right. And so they need to, you know, understand the gospel and understand the Bible and understand the view. And then when they give their life to Jesus, then one day they will start to kind of act and follow the ways of Jesus and be obedient. But what he just said flipped it. And he said, you will know if your will is to actually do God's will. If you want to obey God, then you will start to do that and you will then come to know. It's like when people talk about fake it till you make it. It's like you actually do some practice in a certain rhythm and pattern of life, and over time that starts to actually shape your affections to do the will of God in your life. He flips the order, and it's a beautiful thing because here's what he's doing. He's saying, I want people not just to believe some stuff, but to obey some stuff, socially, morally, understanding that God has this desire in your life. And the Christian life is not just about believing some doctrines, it's actually living out the Christian life. You're submitting to God's will, he says. There's God's will, and you don't just get to believe in a bunch of doctrine, you actually have to do the will of God. Now, over and over and over again, Jesus talks about this in his teachings and the New Testament talks about it. So we rarely talk about it. Let me just show you a couple. Matthew chapter 7, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of the Father, right? Pretty big idea. And then he says, I appeal to you, brothers, by the mercies of God, this is Romans chapter 12, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that by the testing you may discern what is the will of God. All right, that's Romans 12. 1 John chapter 2. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. I'll give you one more. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. So there's this idea that the will of God is actually the thing that we need to follow. We need to figure out how to follow it, and then our affections will actually follow that, and we'll actually start to know God. Now, here's the problem. How do we know what the will of God is? This is where the confusion comes in our life. And I want to try to free you from some of that confusion. Now, here's what I mean. I'll give you an illustration. So during COVID lockdown, there was these moments of different rules going on that the government was kind of laying out, right? So there was like, you can do this, and then you can have six people, you know, your safe six, and then you could have the 30, and then you could hang out with them inside, then you could hang out with them outside. And it was one of these moments where we think we're in this moment where people could come into our house and hang out and do all, and so, but six people only. And so we had these six people, and we had this meal, and we went through kind of the Seder meal. It was actually it was April Fool's Day. It was Easter. So we got together for Easter and did like this kind of Jesus is the fulfillment of the Seder meal. Went through all these steps and, you know, it's kids and this family. It's beautiful. All the kids go upstairs. Adults are hanging around my living room after. It's the two couple, myself and one other couple. And we're hanging out and the kids are upstairs making a movie or something. And the phone rings in my house, the house phone, which is like, I didn't even know we had one, but the phone rings off the wall. I'm like, what's happening? So I pick up the phone and say, hello. And they say, hey, it's the RCMP. And I'm like, uh-oh. And now I'm like, oh, there's some neighbor who's probably called the cops on us because we have these people over, right? So now it's like, oh my goodness, what's happening? And they're like, hey, just wondering, everything's okay now. Yeah, everything's great now. Okay, how you feeling tonight, sir? Feeling great, how are you feeling? Great, we're just gonna send a car over to check on you. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, we've had a call from inside the house. And I'm like, okay. And I'm not even sure I hung up the phone, all right? I threw the phone and then ran upstairs and all the kids are in this room, they're shooting this movie and I'm like, leave now, because I don't know the rules at this moment. I'm like, oh my goodness, the cop's gonna come. This family's not allowed to be here. And I just go into the room and the kids are, I'm like, everyone leave now. And they're like, bah. And they all started to laugh and said, ha, happy April Fool's Day. And I'm like, no, you idiots, leave now. The cops are coming. And they're like, bah, happy April Fool's Day. I'm like, oh my goodness. So now the other parents are like, what are you doing? And I'm like, that you gotta get out of here. I don't know what the rules are, but you're in my house. We're gonna get arrested. We're gonna get thrown in jail. We're gonna get whatever. And so we gotta get out. So they're like, get out of here. And the kid, one of the kids is dressed up in one of my shirts because they're shooting a movie. He rips my shirt off and he just throws it. And so you got this whole family running down our cul-de-sac to where one kid doesn't have a shirt on. They're all screaming about April Fool's Day. They all get in the car and they just take off. And then I'm sitting there like, what? So never has a house been cleaned faster in the history of time, all right? Just like literally dishes. The next morning we woke up, there was dishes in our microwave, dishes in our oven. I mean, it was crazy. It was like, shoom, and the cop comes to the door. Ding dong, we're like, hey, how's it going? You know, we're all in our PJs now. And it's like just all got like a hot cup of coffee. Oh, hi, I didn't know you were here. And he's like, hey, how's everybody? I'm like, everybody's great. He's like, okay, cool. Just wanted to check. He left. And it turned out one of the kids didn't know probably even what 911 actually was. And for the movie, they just picked up one of the phones. They didn't think it was connected to the wall, dialed 911. And cops are like, oh my goodness, we got to come check the house, make sure this guy's, you know, not doing something bad to his family. But it was in this moment. Listen, we didn't know the rules at the moment. They changed so quickly. There's moments where the rules are not super, super clear to you what God wants you to do when you're looking for his will. And so you fumble around a bit in the dark and you do certain things and you're not sure. Can I just give you the freedom? That's exactly how it is. Because he doesn't tell you specific stuff in the Bible. He doesn't tell you the name of the person you're supposed to marry. So stop looking in your alphagettis. He doesn't tell you exactly which city you're supposed to be living. He doesn't tell you exactly what school you're supposed to go to. He doesn't tell you at what age you're supposed to show Shawshank to your daughter when she's 15 and you gotta wait a couple years. These are the questions that aren't in the Bible. These are the things we gotta discern. We gotta figure it out. And so there's 100 of those. How much are you supposed to give to this project? How much are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? You don't know because you can look and look and look, and I think it's in Ephesians, and I think it's in the Hebrew. It ain't, bro. Sis, to be inclusive. It ain't. But there is stuff that is clear. And you know you're doing the will of God. Be baptized. Don't cheat on your spouse. Give your money to kingdom stuff. Give thanks in all circumstances. Be generous. Pay your taxes. Pray. Don't be arrogant. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Help the poor. Love your neighbor. Don't be angry. Don't be prideful. Don't covet. Don't be anxious. Don't be jealous. Don't envy. Listen, guys, you do not need a spiritual feeling in your little heart to do those things. He's clarified them in the scriptures clearly. This is what I'm asking you to do. And it's these people who are not afraid to submit to the Bible and what God has said in it. He's saying it's these people, even though the world passes away, it's these people, 1 John, that actually abide forever. And I know you wanna lust and do your thing and you do because you're like afraid God's promises won't actually come true, that if you resist that, he's gonna reward you for it. And you're not sure because it feels good in the moment, so you do it. And you do the same with greed, and you do the same with shopping, you do the same with pride, you do the same with arrogance. You're just not sure God's actually going to show up and do the promises thing. And so you just do that thing, and you're trying to figure it out. And then the church or people teaching the Bible or whatever tell you this is probably what you need to do with your life, and you don't really want to do that thing. So then you just go, well, I don't like what the church thinks about this, and I don't like what the Bible says about this, and that was ancient, and I don't want to follow it anymore. And this is all our discernment process of what is the will of God for my life, and how do I do it? And we push back. N.T. Wright says this: people often accuse Christians of advancing their own ideas rather than God's when the people concerned don't really want to hear what God has to say to them. Blaming the church is a convenient way of ignoring God's costly and demanding call on your life. That's what he's saying. And then he says, the end of this text in John chapter 7, the one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks glory of him who sent him is true. There's only two kinds of people in the world. You seek your own glory or the Father's glory, and in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Look at this. Yet none of you keeps the law. Can I just land this here? Galatians 3 says the same thing. The law gives life, but no one can actually succeed at keeping it perfectly. So that's why Jesus had to come and die. There's a kind of humility. No one keeps it perfectly. There's a kind of beauty and humility that comes out of that, because now religion doesn't get to crush you. Because as Jesus says here, you can't keep the law perfectly without Jesus. And so when we start to understand about our own life, we understand that we're sinful. Let Jesus tell you right now, you've not ever been perfect at keeping the law. There's a sin in your life that needs to be dealt with. There's the reason you are who you are. It's not just your parents' problem and fault. It's not just your teacher. It's not education. It's not the systems. It's not the politician. It's you. There's something in you that's sinful, and you can't ever be a perfect person. How many counseling sessions have I done with people where the wife or the husband will come in and just slay the other one with their list of ways that they're wrong, and how quickly I look at them and say, really, and you have no part in this? You ever looked in the mirror? And usually that's our last session. Because maybe part of it's your problem. Problem is, we view ourselves the opposite of what Jesus just said here. We view ourselves as good. And so we can never get ourselves to a place where we need the grace of Jesus. We always think it's them. It's those people. It's not me. I'm good because I understand my own motives. But then you begin to realize how crazy it is that you program yourself to think that way long enough, and you can't even see anymore outside the matrix of your own brain and the lies you tell yourself. Psychologists have a heyday with this stuff because it's fascinating. You look at yesterday, I was thinking about how scary this is. Pavlov's dog, you know, that famous, you know, you ring the bell, you give a dog dinner, and then all you need to do is ring the bell and it starts to salivate. So that's a program. A dog's brain is just like our brain. It programs like a computer over time. So yesterday I thought about this because my wife had done something with the system. We have this doorbell, and it's like got a little camera in it and stuff. And so she has this app, and you can keep, so it's for all the Amazon packages that come to our house. So it's like that shut down. So she had to reboot it. And so she's sitting at the front door, and she'll ring the doorbell, and she rings the doorbell. And my dog is sitting there. She's looking at Aaron. She knows who it is. There's no strangers around. But she rings the doorbell, and my dog starts going, rah, 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 starts barking like a crazy person. But she only barks when new people arrive to her. She doesn't bark when Aaron's just standing around. But you ring the doorbell, and her brain says bark because it's programmed like a computer. This is what's scary about all of us. We program into ourselves to not really believe that we're sinful, to not really believe that we're wrong, but it's always those people over there. And so we divide and we start to judge people. And this is what Jesus has a constant problem with, because he says, has not Moses given you the law? And look at how the passage ends. He says, do not, verse 24, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. What happens is we think we're so good, we're not sinful, so we judge those people. Yeah, but they're gay, so I'm gonna judge them. Well, I'm gonna judge you because you're anti-gay. Now we got some division. And now we got some pride welling up in us. We know what's what. Well, they cheated on their spouse before. They've never cheated on their spouse before, so I can't listen to them because they're too righteous. They should have been marching in that parade. They should not have been marching in that parade. I heard that they're anti-vax, terrible. I heard that they're pro-vax, terrible. I heard that they wear a mask. When they, who's these masked people? Well, I heard that they don't wear a mask. What a jerk. And all of a sudden, we justify and we justify and divide and divide. I had people send me an email telling YouTube videos saying, if you're a real pastor, you'll preach this. And it's like, when do I show up to your workplace and tell you how to do your job? We're all getting so full of pride, aren't we? Thinking our team is right, telling each other they're wrong, they're right. Election season just gets worse. They're right, they're wrong. Pride, pride, pride. I had a guy, there was a guy interested in joining one of our sites that we're launching in one of the cities. And there was a picture that was posted of me like a year ago when I was wearing these shoes. Okay, check this out, okay? He calls up the church, the guy planning the church. He goes, I'm leaving. I mean, we haven't even started the church yet, so I'm leaving the church. It's like people love that phrase. I'm leaving the church because Mark is wearing Gucci shoes, and those shoes, I looked them up, they're $1,000. I can't believe, what is this, preachers and sneakers? Who does this guy think he is? And I'm never coming back to your church. Delete my email, never talk to me again. Buddy, these are Aldos. They cost me $50. They ain't Gucci's. Who do you think you are? Who do we all think we are? Judging people with no understanding of what their situation is in their life at their particular time. You don't know what they do for a living. You don't know the situation that they're in. Don't project who you are in your situation on everybody else and judge them on outward appearances. Or else you will divide and divide and divide until your own soul is so withered that you don't understand that you're the one. Every single one of us is the one that's in need of the grace of God in our life. None of us obeys the law perfectly, which is why the great parable in Luke is about the guy standing and saying, thank God I'm not like this sinner. And the sinner just has his head and goes, I need your grace. And the parable is, it's the second one that went away justified. First one's heart is too. This is why Jesus had to come and die on a cross for our sin, guys. This is why he rose again, because our pride will keep us away from understanding our own need. It will mess with our brain. It will program us to tell the lies and create the narrative. And Jesus is going, you all need to be recipients of this grace. So Father, I just pray in this moment, whether we're watching this in one of our sites or watching this online or listening to this podcast, whatever, that we would receive the grace of Jesus. We would be humble enough to understand it's not in us and them. You aren't better than them. We all have blind spots that we need to be self-aware of. Lord, show us those things and let us walk in humility, because none of us can fulfill the law of God perfectly. And that's why you sent Jesus. Let that create in us that understanding of our own sinfulness, the understanding of our proclivity to not get information right all the time, that we would, there be a humility in all of it. That we would walk out of a place of understanding the beautiful reality that even though we don't have it right every time in every way, you forgive us and choose to use us anyway. This is crazy. And let us extend that same grace to other people. In Jesus' great name we pray. Amen.